All right, our next speaker is Gerald Cleaver, and he's speaking on the multiverse, God's indeterminacy, and action.
Thank you. And thank you for the preceding talk, Steve. I'll be able to skip over some things here on mine in terms of general cosmology. I want to talk about the theme of multiverse and with regard to God's what I'll call indeterminacy in action. And this is based on my participation in the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences Saturn Project, which was supported by a grant from Calvin College, funded by JTF, the idea of indeterminism. It was a study of indeterminism at many more levels in nature, ranging from macroscopic. The purpose was to study the scientific warrants for and theological implications of randomness, propensities, and indeterminism in nature. The theology and the science community have made a strong case for closely related claims that, one, God acts at the atomic and subatomic levels of nature, two, that such divine action makes objective differences in the course of nature, and three, that God does so without violating or suspending natural processes. Bob Russell refers to this divine action of this nature as noaida, or non-interventionist objective divine action. And the purpose of Saturn, the program, was to study the possibility that discoveries in the natural sciences over the past decade point to indeterminism at many more levels in nature, ranging from macroscopic, physical, and biological process of daily life to the universe as a whole. And I was focusing on the universe, i.e. the multiverse as a whole. And I start off in my study, or my paper, considering the relationship between the divine will of the Creator, the freedom of the natural world, and the free will of human beings as a factor that continues to be debated. Scripture, traditions, and theology provide no clear answer to the nature of divine will. This free will dichotomy, the opposing sides claim the same scriptural support for their views. The varying range of views has shown up in some interesting surveys. A 2006 survey conducted by our Institute for Studies of Religion at Baylor and founded by the John Templeton Foundation revealed that 54% of Americans believe that God is, quote, engaged in every creature's life and world affairs, while 46% believe that God does not generally intervene with his creation, the life of Christ being the most acknowledged exception among other possible biblical events. Christians in the survey are closely divided between the two categories, with fundamentalists and evangelicals believing predominantly in the interventionist God, and members of the mainline Protestant churches and Catholics believing predominantly in the non-interventionist God. There's subfields of these two that are somewhat interesting statistics also. Those who believe in an interventionist God, 57% view God as a simultaneously, quote, angry at humanity's sin and ready to throw the thunderbolt of judgment down to the unfaithful or ungodly, whereas in contrast, 43% perceive God primarily as forgiving. Among those who believe in a primarily non-interventionist God, 45% of this group also view God as critical, while 55% perceive God as distant-like cosmic force or disengaged, as in deism. Some people's views, in fact, may overlap both categories, and that believe in God who acts within creation while carrying out his will purely or at least primarily through processes obeying the physical laws of the universe. God is then understood as the primary cause and the physical laws as the secondary. Ian Barber and John Polkinghorne are proponents of this view. As we know, strong tension between science and theology has existed in the U.S. for approximately about 120 years. Presently, nearly one-third of young adults with a Christian background believe that, quote, churches are out of step with the scientific world we live in, and a quarter of young adults believe that Christianity is anti-science. As telling, recent surveys conducted by the Associated Press of about 1,000 U.S. adults indicate that Americans have more doubt than acceptance of concepts that scientists accept as firmly established by overwhelming evidence. The Big Bang, the 4.5 billion year age of the Earth, 3.5 billion year evolution of life on Earth are all disbelieved by 50% 51% of the U.S. population. Only about 21% of Americans are confident or extremely confident that the universe did, in fact, begin with the Big Bang of 13.8 billion years ago. And tellingly, acceptance of the scientific conclusion strongly supported by evidence decreases sharply, unfortunately, with increasing theistic belief. Evangelicals and fundamentalist Christians in particular express much doubt with this. So I think a reunification of faith and science within the Christian community is deeply needed. The theology of nature, as coined by Barber, is clearly fundamental to these ideas. And perception of the nature and modes of God's transcendent interaction with creation has advanced significantly over the millennia through growing understanding of the natural world. And this is how I want to tie in with multiverse. Significant steps in theological aspects have often correlated strongly with paradigm shifts in our understanding of the physical world. Each upward paradigm shift of understanding the physical creation has simultaneously promoted growth in theological perception of nature's creator. With each step, the perception of God has increased in grandeur. And I would say this is the idea, rather than seeing in the Copernican mediocrity of us and of Earth, it's not us getting smaller, but it's God getting bigger. It's the grandeur of God's creation that we see that expands and enhances and grows our concept of God, not making us smaller, but God bigger. I think we're finally starting to see Him, God, at the right scale. Each paradigm advancement has shed brighter light on the general methods by which and through which the Creator interacts with all of creation. I just want to go through and summarize quick what I would call the paradigm shifts that we've gone through. And if I think when we go back to Old Testament understanding and of Genesis and all, the perception of heavens at that time was not distinct to the Jewish people. It was a general picture of the Mideast as a whole. This three-tier paradigm of the ancient Mideast world from about prehistory to about 300 BC had the concept, again, the three-tier, the flat, local earth, the firmament of the stars and the heavens, and the underworld. This was not just the Jewish people, but the general perception, even of the early Greeks. Then, of course, we went to the geocentric paradigm from Greco-Roman until the 1600s, the longest-lasting picture of creation during a human time so far. Then we went to the heliocentric paradigm from the 1600s through the 1700s. We're already getting short. We can see that scientific advancement is accelerating. This heliocentric paradigm really only lasted for about 100 years or so, 200. Then we were in the galacticentric paradigm, as I'll call it, from the 1800s through the 1920s. And again, there was good discussion in the last talk about why this changed in the 1920s, why we went from the galactocentric paradigm to the what I'll call the universe-centric paradigm. Now we're on the scale of the universe, again, in the same picture. And again, this the observable region of the universe we now know, and this is just, it's not cubical as we know, just to emphasize three dimensions here, though. You know, we're talking about a trillion galaxies within the observable part of the universe, up to, in the largest and most dense, up to about a trillion stars per galaxy. And I would say, so far, we've been in from the 1920s to the 21st century. Now, we've been in the universe-centric picture. But modern cosmology, the idea of the Big Bang and inflation, and many other aspects are suggesting more to this, that we really are on the stage, the next stage of going beyond, from universe-centric to what I'll call multiverse-centric. And again, as we know, as we've covered in different talks here, the history of the universe is now well understood back to a fraction of a second after the Big Bang explosion of space itself. You know, both to large scale and to small scale. We now understand back, as the physics should have been, to the point of about 10 to the minus 40th of a second. And what happened before that is what we're filling in now, and what the implications of inflation as a whole predict. I can go over a short history of the universe, but we've already had enough. We've already talked to it. I'll do it very short. I'll skip over now, CMB. And again, the idea of the accelerating universe. To get to an accelerating universe now, and understanding that, and understanding the type of physics that will produce the inflationary stage, we're led to the idea of a multicentric picture, which I would say is the next step, in the next paradigm shift that we are at and need to seriously consider. One of the ideas, I'm going to talk a bit about string theory itself, but one of the concepts that suggesting a multiverse century is the physics that will produce an inflationary stage. All of the potentials that can create an inflationary physics are such that it's unlikely to imagine that just a single universe went through a single inflationary stage. The analogy I like to use for that is the analogy of a pot of boiling water. The water has reached 100 degrees Celsius, and I'm looking at a pot of boiling water, and I see one bubble come out, and I stand there, I watch there for a day, a year, 1,000 years, and only see one bubble come out. How probable is that? Instead, if it reaches boiling, it's a vast number of bubbles, the nucleation. It's the same thing, the physics that we see that would produce one universe to inflate is unlikely to only be one. We were going to expect a vast number of universes at the same time. And it could be that some potential will be derived sometime that only has a single inflationary mode, but that is unlikely even from the physics as we know. And then multiverses are a viable scientific concept that need to be examined. And I think, again, and they are, and we are at the stage where there's some fluctuation. We might be in a mixed quantum mechanical state saying multiverse yes, multiverse no. We're looking and examining the multiverse yes condition. Up to the point where Max Tegmark at the University of Chicago has classified in sort of a multiverse taxonomy in four levels. I denoted these by L1, 2, 3, and 4. And that this is his work. The simplest multiverse is something that cosmologists as a whole, whether multiverse or not, generally accept. Level one multiverse, it's a general prediction of cosmological inflation. It's a space-time which contains expanding Hubble volumes. And Hubble volume is defined as, for us, it's the observable universe. But if we go, there's nothing. We look at our observable universe. We see a continuous symmetry. The mass energy density is fairly constant on the universal scale. There's nothing that suggests to us that if we could go right now, we stop the universe from expanding. We can, and let's just assume theoretically that we are able to travel much faster than the speed of light. We start here and we go instantly to the edge of what would be the observable universe now. What would we expect there? We shouldn't expect to see a sign that says stop, you're at the end of the observable universe. We would expect to see the patterns in the observable universe to continue. We would expect the mass energy distribution, galactic patterns, galactic clusters to continue as it is. And this would be going into, from our point of view, a different Hubble region, a different observable section. So we should expect the universe to continue as it is from beyond the observable sector to what is now the non-observable sector. And this is the idea of L1. It's basically saying that the universe is very likely, given that it's flat, it's very likely infinite, that there's no boundary to it. The only other possible exception, basically, if it's going to be flat, is there could be periodic boundary conditions. That means that if the universe could stop an expansion and we keep going forward, we might eventually find that we end up back where we started. The simplest extension of that is a torus, a donut shape. A torus is flat. So this is the only really possible exception to an infinite universe is torus shape. This does fit in with string theory, and there's some probability of this. But given that we're not able to see the same galactic structures in both directions, means that the size, if the universe is flat but toroidal in all three spatial dimensions, the length of, or effectively the radius in any given direction, has to be a much larger than at least twice 13.8 billion light years. So it has to be at least 50 billion light years beyond in any given direction, and closer likely to at least 100 or so. Otherwise, we could see the same thing or at different stages in both directions. So level one universe is, again, this just idea of an infinite, vast universe like ours. It has the same laws of physics everywhere. Just because our universe extends infinitely doesn't mean that we should expect the laws of physics to change within that vast volume, that multiverse. So a level one multiverse is defined as likely an infinite region in which the same laws, the same fundamental measurable laws of physics apply. That would mean gravity plus the electroweak strong nuclear forces everywhere. Same number of forces, same type. It does get into this one issue that Max Tegmark studies, and that is the idea that there, in a level one multiverse, there are only so many combinations and patterns of physical structure that fundamental particles can form. So Max Tegmark has suggested that one implication of an infinite universe, same laws of physics, is that you might have repeats in physical structures there. But I don't have time to get into that. Level two multiverse is that, and this is what I study from string theory, that given a fundamental law of physics, i.e. something, string theory, some underlying equations, that there are different regions of space-time that can exhibit different effective laws of physics due to string theory, due to different numbers and shapes of the compact dimensions, corresponding to different locations and a landscape of possibilities. This is saying that there can be an overarching set of fundamental mathematical laws, and there are a vast to infinite number of solutions to that. And those solutions are themselves a unique set of physical laws defined by physical forces. So level two allows some fundamental mathematical theory to predict a vast or infinite number of different universes. And so this is the next step. You have different level one multiverses. Each level one multiverse has a distinct set of physical laws, but different. And like string theory predicts that there would be on the order of 10 to the 500 different level one multiverses. Each one has a unique set of physical laws. I don't have time to go more into that, but this is what I study as a string theorist. And then the issue that we focus on there is, how probabilistic is the existence of our universe with our specific set of physical laws within the overarching level two multiverse that has a specific string, overall set of mathematical equations of string theory that allow for 10 to the 500 different set of physical laws defining its own universe? Level three concept of multiverse is something that's been around too and gets more into the philosophical stage. These are called Everett universes, named after the mathematician and the physicist Hugh Everett, based on the idea that every time in quantum mechanics that a decision, either conscious or of nature, is made, that a given universe branches off into all possibilities. You know, that would be like quantum mechanically, there's the quantum mechanical cat. He's put into an enclosed chamber set up with a radioactive element. There's some chance that he's both, that he might die from that if the radioactive element sets off a poison gas, or if it doesn't, he's alive. So you have Schrodinger cat, which is both dead and alive until you open up and see what happens. Hugh Everett says that both cases exist. There will be one universe where the cat lives and one universe where the cat dies, and they both exist simultaneously, separate. And that's the level three universe. Level four, as defined by Max Tegmark, is the ultimate level. It is the collection of all possible level 3, 2, and 1 universes. And so it's the complete set of multiverses formed of all consistent mathematical structures. And that mathematical structure includes the Everett universe, set 2. So things stop at level 4. It's not quite as complicated taxonomy as in biology, but there's still four different levels. Each one includes the other. But so there's a lot of work going on right now in multiverse classification on the philosophical, mathematical, and scientific side, and where you would describe multiverse fits in all three of those poles varies quite a bit, and that's one thing that makes it more controversial. Some people would say it's pure philosophy. Some would say it's more mathematics. Some of us, at least to level two, argue that we're still staying in predictive physics. And there are actually predictions in terms of probabilities that one can make with it. And to me, what I see in all of this is that we are really reaching a new stage of the grandeur of God's creation. And God as creator is much more vast than I think ever before. And it's shorter time, but there are a lot of theological and philosophical implications that one has to examine in multiverse theory. And this is something that I like to spend my spare time on beyond string theory itself and thinking about. And I don't have time to go through those here, but there are quite a few. But the one thing that, to me, that makes sense with multiverse, even at level one or level two, is that it's more of what, you know, for I think most of my life I have expected of the true God, that something vast, much more vast in creation. If it is the nature of God to create, it seems that God would create infinitely, not finitely. If God is interesting in interacting with creation, if we go back to the understanding of God in the 1200s, and suddenly I can't think of the name, Anselm's ontological argument, that God is that which there is nothing greater than we can imagine. And so if it is of the nature of God to create, and God is infinite, for God to create finitely seems inherently against God's very nature. That if we live in just a finite universe with a finite lifetime, that means a finite number of created beings that God would make. And I could always argue then that, okay, I think God would be greater if there were not n created beings, but n plus one, and on. And until we reach an infinite number of creations of God, I think we are not having a full representation of God and of his capabilities and nature. What type of infinity and number of creation we're dealing with, that, I would agree, has philosophical aspects. And I think that tells us more about the characteristic of God. But I think we should not be afraid to imagine that God has created infinitely and continues to create infinitely. And I'll stop with that.
Yes? There's 10 string theories or something like that, and then united in M theory, I guess. Do all of them predict multi-universes?
Now, we don't even talk about all of them. It is just one. It is M theory, and it's fit all of them together and shown that all of the five original string theories are equivalent. And yeah, and string theory itself, when it had just these five and went through its first stage for about the first 10 years, 85 to 95, allowed for the existence of one universe at a time. And there was only about, it was about 100 trillion possible different physical universes that could come out of string theory. And it was possible to have just one of them at a time. But when you talk about multiverse, you've combined everything. It is very odd in string theory itself to, and there's no real understanding of how one could just have one universe at a time. It does suggest that we have this entire landscape, theoretical of 10 to the 500 different physical universes, and then the realization of a dense set of those is inevitable. Yeah. Yes?
Yeah, I struggle with a lot of this because it's my background in astronomy leads me to very different conclusions on, even when I've talked to Brian Green myself, who when push comes to shove, he says it's string hypothesis, it's not string theory. Because there is no, my understanding, you talked about evidence, my understanding it is philosophy with smattering of mathematics.
I'd say it's mathematics with three. I want to comment a second.
Yeah.
We use, when in the definition of theory, that is, I would agree, it is not a physical theory. I would not call it the theory meaning the same as gravitational theory. When we talk about string theory, what we're using it in is in the sense of a consistent mathematical structure. theory there is, it's the mathematical use of theory,
right,
not
the physical,
not use.
Physical theory. Yeah, it's,
yeah.
Not a physical theory.
No, it's not physical theory.
It's not, and so it's for cosmology.
When I say string.
Cosmological theory or particles, you know. So the problem being that a lot of this, there's a, you know, a lot of what drives string theory, from what I can understand, is probabilities and mathematics, where you have string theory say, well, this, all of these multiple universes are there, that's because of the, not because it's required physically, but because there's a probabilistic problem. In fact, when you look at, and Penrose argues this as well, when you look at inflationary theory, all the problems that inflation solves, it introduces just as many new ones.
Yep.
And then string theory, you know, tries to fix that by then, you know, getting rid of all the probabilistic problems by having the multi-universe. But again, it's a way of dealing with things, probability problems. It's not a new anything physical. Or is there anything physical that we can touch in any of this?
Yes, one of the things is, right now, to explain the difference, the factor of either 10 to the 120 or 10 to the 60 between the theoretical prediction for the cosmological constant and the experimental value. If we were to assume there is no supersymmetry in the universe, then the theoretical prediction for the cosmological constant is 10 to the 120. If we assume broken supersymmetry at the TeV scale, the prediction is 10 to the 60. And then if it's, and I'm talking in Planck scales, and it corresponding to the physical value of one then, or just take the inverse of all of those. So we're looking at a minimum theoretical versus experimental difference of 10 to the 60. String theory can explain, and in the string theory models, we can easily get this factor of 10 to the minus 120.
Right.
It explains that.
No, they
have to be in discrete values, and we work that out. It says that they are starting all the way from minus 1 to plus 1 in incremental steps of 10 to the minus 120. Yeah, we'll switch on them.
I have some problems with the grandeur argument. I mean, it seems to me we're playing the same sort of game that the opponents of Christianity play when they say the universe is so huge that therefore how can little human beings make any difference. We're playing the same thing if we say God is much grander if he's created this huge universe. I mean, that's one aspect of it. The second thing is, with your argument, that God is continually creating, well, I agree that in some sense God is continually creating our universe, but theologically, God is always Father. I mean, that's in the Arian debate. God is, the Son is eternally begotten, but God is not eternally created. That is, being creator does not belong to the definition of what God is in the same sense as being Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
I think that some would go on to in some sense, redefine, you know, more of the economical trinity as creator, savior, sustainer.
Well, okay, yeah, but that's, I mean, I'm not saying God is not the creator, but the question is whether God, in a sense, whether God has to create.
Oh, right. I would say, okay. Looks like I'm going to have to finish with that one. I agree with you. God does not.
Please finish what you were going to say.
Okay.
And make that the last.
Okay. I would just say, but you're right. There's nothing that demands that God be creator. But given that God does create, I mean, that's the essence of it. If God creates, then we should... then the way in which he is creator should fully represent him. And if God can create n plus one beings to interact with rather than n, we should expect God to do that. Otherwise, we have an infinite God who has created a finite number of beings over a finite time. Yeah. Is that the nature of God?
We should be the God.
Yeah.